On this edition for Saturday, July 4th, the country celebrates Independence Day as coronavirus cases are on the rise. Chicago's controversial method to curb holiday weekend gun violence. And celebrating 20 years of musical cooperation between Israel and Palestine. Next on PBS NewsHour Weekend.
PBS NewsHour Weekend is made possible by Sue and Edgar Wackenheim III, the Anderson Family Fund, Bernard and Denise Schwartz, the Cheryl and Philip Milstein family, Barbara Hope Zuckerberg, Charles Rosenblum. We try to live in the moment to not miss what's right in front of us. At Mutual of America, we believe taking care of tomorrow can help you make the most of today. Mutual of America Financial Group, retirement services and investments. Additional support has been provided by Consumer Cellular and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. And by contributions to your PBS station from viewers like you. Thank you.
Good evening and thank you for joining us. It is the 4th of July, Independence Day, 244 years after the signing of the Declaration of Independence. Instead of parades and picnics, many Americans are staying home as a precaution during the coronavirus pandemic. Others are protesting against racial inequality and police brutality. Despite warnings not to gather in large groups and to wear face masks, the president chose to have a rally and fireworks display at Mount Rushmore in South Dakota last night. Mr. Trump used his speech at the Mount Rushmore National Memorial to rail against, quote, angry mobs trying to tear down statues and what he called a left-wing cultural revolution.
Our nation is witnessing a merciless campaign to wipe out our history, defame our heroes, erase our values, and indoctrinate our children.
There were few face masks and no social distancing at the event, and the president barely mentioned the coronavirus pandemic. Before the speech and fireworks show began, Native Americans and supporters protested on roads leading to the site, which is on land taken from the Lakota Sioux. Police arrested 15 people who refused to leave the area after an imposed deadline. I spoke with Chase Iron Eyes, special advisor to the president of the Oglala Sioux tribe, about the protests and President Trump's visit. So Chase Iron Eyes, I know that some of the concerns leading up to the protests were that the president and the administration never asked permission from the tribes to hold the event there, and that the land has been ruled by the Supreme Court as your land rightfully that the United States has stolen. What happened? What do you think was accomplished with the protests?
Well, a lot of times over the past 500 years, indigenous voices have been completely ignored or deliberately brushed under the rug, so that sometimes that's the only way our voice will be heard, is if we offer our bodies and we place our bodies in harm's way, like we did at the Dakota Access Pipeline, like we'll do at the Keystone Access Pipeline. The religious radical right terrorists who support our current great white father, President Donald Trump, were out in full force yesterday. So we had to let the entire world know that when a man of ill character, according to our treaty, a bad man among the whites, whenever he plans to come into our sacred land without so much as a courtesy call, then we know that a man like that lacks the proper civil decorum. He could have called one of our tribal leaders or some of our chiefs and relayed that message, because he knows, because of his own laws, his own court system, and quite frankly, our own court system since 1924. We had American citizenship imposed on us, whether we wanted it or not. So all of the constitutional rights and natural rights that inhere to American sovereigns also inhere to us as American Indians, but we have an ancient a priori sovereign right to say who can and can't pass through our territory according to the 1851 and 1868 treaties, which are much newer than our United States Constitution, I might add. All of these rights, including our treaty rights and our tribal Indian rights that predate the English language here on this hemisphere, Sometimes that's the only way we have to communicate to the world, is to say, look, it, this means so much to us. Our children's rights to clean water and healthy ecosystems and having land back in 2020. Because the Black Hills, 1.3 million acres, are federal lands.
This is also happening in the context of tension between the tribal nations and the state government on measures you're taking to make sure that the coronavirus doesn't spread.
You know, it's all connected, sir. Not only Trump's visit, but the deliberate visit that Governor Kristi Noem says we are literally not going to social distance. We're not going to concern ourselves with other people's health and well-being. We're going to do the opposite of that. And the health and safety checkpoints that not only the Pine Ridge Reservation, but the Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe and the Rosebud Sioux Tribe and Lower Brule, it's the Lakota Nation, the Sioux Nation. This is the only way that we're going to be able to hope to survive another Eurasian plague. And a lot of our European brothers and sisters, either they feel extra brave because they've survived so many plagues, but we as indigenous nations have a very direct memory of what we went through with smallpox, cholera, Spanish flu. I mean, it hits us harder because we haven't been exposed to those things for that long.
Yesterday, the president spent quite a deal of time talking about how he wants to preserve statues and monuments and how he wants to enforce those laws. One of the subtexts was that if protesters got their way, Mount Rushmore would be demolished or destroyed in some way.
Yes, sir. That's a very important question that cooler heads need to think about, because some people want to blow it up and some people want to worship it like their gods. And so somewhere in the middle of that, we need to have a frank truth-telling and a conciliation so we can go forward in this country together. We need to decide, should we add another face? Should we leave it alone? Because if we destroy it, that is also an act of desecration. Even the Crazy Horse Monument, though that is one of our guys, it's still an act of desecration to do something to the natural universe that wasn't designed to be that way. But right now, we need to be deciding who can we celebrate and in what manner can we celebrate them? Because all of the prior statues are usually monuments to slavery, genocide, and racism. And if I'm an American European, I can't get away from that. So besides telling only the good things about George Washington or Thomas Jefferson or Abraham Lincoln or Teddy Roosevelt, we also need to tell the truth about these men. And maybe we should consider celebrating and idolizing women at this point.
Chase Ironhides, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, sir.
President Trump will hold another 4th of July event tonight and give another speech, this time from the South Lawn of the White House. Local officials opposed having large crowds gather on the National Mall and nearby areas, saying it violates health guidelines during a surge in coronavirus cases. But the administration controls the federal property and is going ahead. The Department of Interior says it will have 300,000 face masks ready to hand out during the fireworks and flyovers of military aircraft. Presumptive Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden tweeted his 4th of July message today. Using images from recent and historic protests, the former vice president said the country has not yet lived up to its founding ideal.
American history is no fairy tale. It's been a constant push and pull between the two parts of our character. The idea that all men and women, all people are created equal, and the racism that has torn us apart.
The rise in coronavirus cases is continuing in many parts of the country this weekend. One of those new cases is a member of President Trump's inner circle. Kimberly Guilfoyle, a top campaign fundraiser and the girlfriend of President Trump's oldest son, tested positive for the virus yesterday. Donald Trump Jr. tested negative. The couple was in South Dakota but did not travel with the president. They are self-isolating as a precaution. Nationwide, there were more than 57,000 new confirmed cases reported yesterday, according to Johns Hopkins University researchers. New daily cases are increasing in 39 states, with sharp upticks in California, Arizona, Texas, and Mississippi, according to the New York Times data. Florida reported 11,458 new cases today, a new record for daily cases. While the number of new cases is increasing, new deaths per day are declining. Experts say the numbers reflect better treatments and the fact that younger people who are less likely to become severely ill account for more of the new cases. Globally, there are more than 11 million confirmed coronavirus cases, according to researchers at Johns Hopkins. But after months of lockdowns, restrictions continue to ease in many places. In England, pubs and restaurants open today for the first time since March. It's the biggest step yet in the country's gradual easing of coronavirus restrictions. Patrons need to stay 1 meter, about 3 feet, from each other, and no one is allowed to stand at the bar, but mask wearing is optional. Barbershops, museums, and libraries also reopen today with social distancing restrictions. But not all of the United Kingdom is opening. Each of the UK's four nations, England, Scotland, Wales, and Northern Ireland, are lifting restrictions independently. In Brazil, bars and restaurants also reopened in parts of the country this week, despite the second largest coronavirus outbreak in the world behind the United States. On Friday, Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro vetoed parts of a law that would have required face masks indoors when large groups gather. Bolsonaro has downplayed the severity of the pandemic despite increasing numbers of infections and deaths in Latin America's largest country. Washington's envoy to Afghanistan continues to push for the U.S.-Taliban peace deal despite recent reports that Russia may have paid bounties to Afghan militants for killing American and NATO soldiers. U.S. Special Representative Zalmay Khalilzad focused on the economic benefits of the deal today. He was wrapping up a week-long trip that included a stop in Qatar, where Taliban representatives are based. In late February, the U.S. signed a peace deal with the Taliban that ended nearly 20 years of war in Afghanistan. The deal has encountered new political opposition and doubts about whether the Taliban can be trusted since news of the intelligence about the Russian bounties became public. For more on the coronavirus pandemic and other national and international news, visit pbs.org/newshour. On Monday, Chicago Police Superintendent David Brown announced the department would deploy 1,200 additional officers over the 4th of July weekend to arrest teenagers found on so-called drug corners. Brown said the strategy aims to reduce the city's holiday gun violence surge because teens are often paid to carry guns, because they can face lighter penalties and get out of jail quickly after their arrest. But an attorney who represents a coalition of community organizations helping to enforce mandatory changes to Chicago's police force says the plan is unconstitutional and contradicts the city's police reform efforts. NewsHour Weekend correspondent Yvette Feliciano spoke with Sheila Beatty, who is also a clinical professor of law at the Northwestern Pritzker School of Law.
So Sheila, what do we know about the plan Superintendent David Brown announced on Monday regarding increasing arrests at these so-called drug corners?
Superintendent Brown announced that he's going to be directing officers to conduct corner sweeps. And what that means is that officers will be going predominantly in the south and west sides of the city and arresting people who are congregating at the corners. The other thing the superintendent requested is that the courts hold people who he arrests, even though he acknowledges that he's going to be arresting people for nonviolent offenses. He's asked that these folks be taken into custody and be held through the holiday weekend.
So what have you been hearing from civil rights activists and criminologists about this policing strategy over the July 4th weekend?
So there's really two main takeaways. Number one, the strategy of conducting these kinds of sweeps is unconstitutional, discriminatory. And number two, it's ineffective. It's not going to create safer communities in the city of Chicago.
What data is there to support that strategies like these aren't effective?
Well, one of the biggest data sets that we have is what's happened in New York City after the end of stop and frisk policing there. And what we found was that crime dropped considerably. There's also a good deal of research into this idea of procedural justice. And that is that when police officers break the law, when they are unaccountable, when they are lawless, that's reflected in the community.
What do you say to arguments that apprehending those at the source of open-air gun markets is essential to ending gun violence right now?
Yeah, well, we just don't have data that suggests that's what works. What we do know works are some of the interventions that we see happening in the streets of Chicago that are led by people most directly affected by gun violence. Interventions led by organizations like Good Kids, Mad City. These are young people, many of whom themselves have lost family members to gun violence, that are actively working to negotiate peace treaties with neighborhoods that may have conflict with each other. Organizations like Mothers Against Senseless Killing, and this is a group of moms who have occupied one of the hottest blocks in Inglewood and have essentially reduced violence on that block significantly by just being a positive force. So it's those types of interventions that build on both the expertise of people who are most affected by gun violence and most affected by corrupt policing. That's what reduces violence in our communities.
Of course, in 2017, we had the U.S. Department of Justice release a report which found that the Chicago Police Department was deficient in training and supervision and prone to excessive force, especially against people of color. What has police reform in Chicago looked like since that report was released?
One of the things that resulted from the Department of Justice's findings is a consent decree. So the City of Chicago Police Department is currently operating under a federal court order. I, along with some other civil rights attorneys, represent a coalition of community-based organizations in the enforcement of that consent decree. And the consent decree overhauls the police department, everything from training to supervision, to use of force, to unbiased policing. It is, and consent decrees have been in other jurisdictions, really powerful tools for transforming police violence and holding police departments accountable. What we've seen in Chicago so far, though, is that the police department has not adhered to any of the really significant deadlines contained in the consent decree. Elected officials talk a good game about police reform. When push comes to shove, we've not seen that translated into policing policies or practices, and we certainly haven't seen it translated into compliance with the consent decree.
Sheila Betty, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
The Israeli-Palestinian conflict remains in deadlock, especially with new plans by Israel to annex occupied territory on the West Bank. However, one remarkable example of cooperation between Arabs and Israelis is celebrating its 20th anniversary this year. It's an orchestra whose young members are both Israeli and Palestinian. Special correspondent David Tereshkov reported on this story before coronavirus shutdowns were in effect.
The Divan Orchestra is the creation of two cultural giants from the Middle East, pianist and conductor Daniel Barenboim, who's an Israeli citizen, and Edward Said, the Palestinian academic and critic. Said died in 2003, but his widow still works to keep the foundation going that supports the orchestra.
Their friendship was based on whatever they had in common, and what they had in common was music. The idea of the orchestra is to get people from the Arab world and Israel to get to know the other in a humanistic project whose language is music.
They named the orchestra Divan, an Arabic word for a council or assembly, to denote a coming together of disparate people. At 77 now, Daniel Barenboim delegates some leadership roles to his son Michael. He's a violinist and, like his father, believes the orchestra offers the Middle East an example for forging better relations between Arabs and Israelis.
The idea is to offer an alternative model of thinking for the region that is not based on conflict, but more on understanding, dialogue.
It begins on the ground with an elementary level school in the desert city of Ramallah on the Israeli-occupied West Bank. Finding young Israeli Jews with the required talent is relatively easy, since the Jewish community has a long cultivated tradition of musical education. But it's harder to find Arab children with a developed aptitude for Western classical music. The foundation scours Arab areas, including the West Bank refugee camps. The recruiters found violinist Yamin Sadi of Nazareth when he was very young, or perhaps he found them.
None of my family is a musician, or none of my friends were musicians. When I was in first grade, I saw somebody playing the violin on TV. Back then, the Barenboim Said Conservatory opened in Nazareth, where I had my first lessons.
Yamin was 10 years old when he auditioned before the maestro, Daniel Barenboim.
He liked what I played. He said that I want to join the orchestra. And then he said, yes, you can, but you're a bit too young. And I said, okay, but if it helps you, I can say I'm 21.
So it took a little longer, until he was just 11, in fact, before he did finally make it into the orchestra, where most new entrants begin at 18. And he's played there now for 12 years. Achieving harmony in the music they all play is an obvious aim. Getting people from such differing, even antagonistic, backgrounds to harmonize outside of music presents bigger challenges.
Most of the disagreements are about the political situation in the area.
Inevitably, it's when the violence around them reaches a crescendo that tensions get to be most serious.
When they are playing together and the situation is dire, like during the Lebanon War in 2006, during the Gaza bombardments in 2014, you can hear it in what they give you in the music. And audiences resonate to that. They see that they are saying something different than regular musicians.
When we all come from so many different backgrounds, it's normal to have different opinions about things.
And what happens?
We try to discuss it. When we try to understand why are we different and what are the different opinions, sometimes we agree to disagree.
It's especially valuable, according to Mariam Saeed, that the orchestra offsets, in some measure, the inequalities that result from Israeli dominance.
For the Arabs, this is a big thing, that when they are sitting in the orchestra playing together, they are equal. And the other that has been brought up to think that he or she are superior than the other side, realize that here we are equal.
You will not find any orchestra where everyone gets along. It doesn't exist, and it's also not realistic. But there's something happening in this group when they play together, when they spend time together, that is just something I've not seen elsewhere.
A subset to the orchestra has developed, drawn from the string section, a chamber music group of just 8 members. It's a more intimate team than the full orchestra, and until COVID-19 stopped all travel, its leaner numbers were easier to send on tour. Cellist Astrid Cyranosian, whose Arabic-speaking family sought refuge over generations all across the Middle East, finds the chamber ensemble to be ideal for forging the closest kind of cooperation.
Chamber music was a music of family. It was to play in the living rooms. We are, of course, all having our differences and our different ways of seeing things, but we talk about it and we talk a lot, and there is no border in between us.
The Divan players were determined to take their musical message to a wider audience beyond the Middle East. Just before the world started shutting down with anti-pandemic restrictions, the chamber group reached for the top in the United States.
The orchestra members have played at many prominent venues. Now they get to play at that international pinnacle of musical excellence, Carnegie Hall.
You always hear about Carnegie Hall. It felt a bit like a jam session. It was very friendly, very warm atmosphere. The feeling of being there, it's very rewarding.
Other rewards coming from these young musicians' collaboration could even include, according to Mariam Saeed, a template for tackling the enmity that has bedeviled the Middle East.
We have already produced a generation that can talk to the enemy. Perhaps these people from both sides who can talk to each other, in the future, they may find an alternate way to resolve bigger issues.
Do you think, in a broad sense, you're contributing in any way to lessening of tensions in an area where we know politically it's deadlock?
Well, I think that would be a little bit optimistic, to be honest, but we play music together. That offers some kind of different view on the Middle East could look like. But this kind of conflict, and it's not the Mendelssohn Octet that will that will bring peace to the Middle East. We do what we can. We're musicians, so what we can do is play music.
Finally tonight, scientists and divers have discovered evidence of ochre mining in Mexico's Yucatan Peninsula from more than 12,000 years ago in underwater caves. Artifacts included digging tools, navigational markers, and extraction pits. The three caves, once above ground, were submerged due to sea level rise more than 7,000 years ago. Ochre has traditionally been used for body painting, rock art, and possibly medicine. That's all for this edition of PBS NewsHour Weekend. For the latest news updates, visit pbs.org/newshour. I'm Hari Srinivasan. Stay healthy and have a safe 4th of July holiday. Thanks for watching and have a good night.
PBS NewsHour Weekend is made possible by Sue and Edgar Wackenheim III. The Anderson Family Fund. Bernard and Denise Schwartz. The Cheryl and Philip Milstein Family. Barbara Hope Zuckerberg. Charles Rosenblum. We try to live in the moment to not miss what's right in front of us. At Mutual of America, we believe taking care of tomorrow can help you make the most of today. Mutual of America Financial Group, Retirement Services and Investments.
For 25 years, Consumer Cellular's goal has been to provide wireless service that helps people communicate and connect. We offer a variety of no-contract plans, and our U.S.-based customer service team can help find one that fits you. To learn more, visit consumercellular.tv.
Additional support has been provided by and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and by contributions to your PBS station from viewers like you. Thank you.